Okay, here's three facts. Australian cities are among the fastest growing in the developed world. Melbourne will soon be the largest city in Australia. And we don't have great public transport and we have congested city roads. Now, if you take fact one and two and project them onto fact three, our poor public transport and congested roads, we have serious problems as our cities get bigger. And that's not even mentioning schools, hospitals or affordable housing. So what to do? Now, this is a topic that one of my next guests, Rob Adams, explores in an essay he's written for the next edition of Griffith Review. Rob is the Director of City Design and Projects at the City of Melbourne, and he's also a member of the Cities of the Future Council of the World Economic Forum, and his essay is called The Tale of Two Cities. Also joining me in this discussion is John Stanley. John is an adjunct professor at the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies at the Business School at the University of Sydney. He's also chair of ADC Forum, a leadership development group which has had several national infrastructure summits. So he's well versed in the problems we have, and I'm sure how to solve them. Both Rob and John are in our Melbourne studios. Gentlemen, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Yes, good morning, Tom.
This is an area that you're both fully immersed in. John, let's start with you. How about the government? We now have a federal ministry for cities. Sydney, for example, has a Greater Sydney Commission. There's an Australian infrastructure plan. Is the government better geared towards making our cities more sustainable?
Well, I think all our governments realise that they need to be doing something in that space, but they probably haven't got their conversation together to do it in an integrated way across levels of government at the moment. So you're seeing state governments, for example, that are primarily responsible for planning our cities, still not integrating land use and transport as well as they should. Local government, which has got a really important role to play in delivery, being in a sense out on a limb in terms of that conversation, less so in Sydney thanks to that new Greater Sydney Commission. Mm-hmm. And the federal government starting to get pretty active, but not really sure what the conversation's about fully yet and how it should integrate with the states and local government in that process. So there are encouraging signs, but there's a lot of work to be done, particularly in a governance sense.
Yeah, well, I've read that the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, wants to adopt a British model called City Deals. Is that something similar to value capture? I mean, I know Saturday Extra has looked at this in the past, but John, is it a similar concept? Can you explain what it means here?
Well, I think the City Deals is really about trying to give cities more accountability and responsibility for their own performance. And so in the UK, the national government's actually devolving some responsibilities to cities in return for, if you like, performance in areas such as driving growth, sharing jobs around, for example, more equitably across the city. And part of that process then involves how you're going to fund that. And part of the funding comes from the federal government or the national government in the UK with the dividend, if you like, that they expect to get in a form of national value capture from stronger economic growth. At a city level, when you're looking at things like major rail projects, in Melbourne's case, for example, the Melbourne Metro, you can expect that to drive significant growth, and there ought to be a value capture component helping to pay for that. That may or may not be part of the City Deals arrangement, but the notion of City Deals where the federal government and if you like, the states on behalf of the cities sit down together to work out what the priorities ought to be and how they're going to pay for them is fundamental. We're not actually seeing that happening yet, though.
And taking the full burden for infrastructure away from governments. Now, in your essay, Rob, you discuss, I think, four policy levers that we need to adopt if we're going to accommodate this huge increase in population. Now, you've noted here that Melbourne will be close to 8 million by 2050. One of those levers that you suggest is freezing any further extension of the city's boundaries. That's to stop the urban sprawl, as there's plenty of evidence that it's not sustainable. So the alternative is to build up. That's also a psychological mind shift for most Australians. How do we go about that?
Well, firstly, you know, if you said to me you only had one thing you could do out of the four I've given, it would be containment. Containment is actually going to the cause of all the symptoms we're looking at, you know, whether it be congestion, family violence, obesity, health, all of those things, affordability. Containment starts to force a different mindset. It starts to say, how do we get more out of what we've got? If you're going to double the size of a city in 30 to 40 years, you're not going to be able to build it in the same way as you've done in the past. So you're going to have to arrive at a point, we can't build any more roads. How do we make the roads we've got more efficient? And that will go for all asset classes in our infrastructure. So that, I think, is the realization that I don't think Australia's come to yet. When we talk infrastructure, we're going to go and build something new. Give you a simple example. When trains started to become congested in Melbourne a few years ago, state government gave free transport before 7 o'clock. What that did is they shifted 2,600 people to before 7 o'clock. It cost them $15 million over a period of, I think it was about 10 years, but it saved them the purchase of four or five trains. So net gain was $85 million to just re-timetable.
What about the role model of Vancouver in Canada? I mean, you say in your essay that's actually minimised its city boundaries. How did it do that?
Well, it basically said if the land hadn't been built on yet, it would go back to agricultural land, and they brought the boundaries in.
They shrunk the boundaries.
They actually shrunk it, yeah. Now, that's a big call, and I can imagine a lot of people getting concerned about that. But we don't really need to do that. What we've got to say is we're big enough. If we start to then incrementally within that growth boundary start to be wiser with the way we deal with our infrastructure, we can over that 30 or 40 years accommodate that population. And we've done the study. It's in a study called Transforming Australian Cities. And you can do it on less than 10% of the land, close to the existing infrastructure, and you're going to save $440 billion in infrastructure over that period.
John, this is where housing affordability comes into it, right? I mean, these units that are near public transport, they often have premium prices attached. So is this one of the major issues governments need to address to make our cities more affordable?
Yes, it's interesting. If you look at successful cities around the world, they've almost all got problems of affordable housing. And it seems to be one of the corollaries, if you like. The more successful you are, the bigger the problem you're going to have of housing affordability. And it's interesting, the pursuit of transit-oriented development, which Rob's promoting and I very strongly support, and I mean, and just to develop a little more on that Vancouver model, I mean, Vancouver has half of its growth actually happening close to its major public transport network. And it set a really high target of no growth in vehicle kilometres of travel over the next 30 years for the city, and that's enabled it then to push back and come up with the kind of public transport and other projects that it needs to deliver that outcome. But if we're going to go for a push into transit-oriented development, then we do have to really, really carefully look at the issue of gentrification and affordability. And that's probably going to push us down the path of having to look at solutions like inclusion rezoning, where you require a certain proportion of the property to be affordable to people on lower middle income housing. We're going to have to look at the innovation in the way we actually build a lot of our more dense housing, and that's an area that Rob can talk at length about, I'm sure. We have to look at things like car parking requirements for new buildings. I mean, if we don't get the cost of a family-friendly dwelling down by about $100,000 in our major cities, it'll be really hard to deliver that sort of intensification that we need.
Yeah, well, we talk about these inner-city suburbs and the fringe suburbs. What about the middle suburbs? I mean, they're missing out on these things. Rob, if they grow in density, is there more pressure to build the infrastructure and the jobs for people to live and work in these suburbs instead of having to commute?
Well, I think if you start to actually say we've contained and we're now going to put development in and around the transport infrastructure, the very nature of that decision starts to say, well, the development will occur in Melbourne along tram lines and around rail stations. That, with that concentration of development, which won't go back into the suburbs, it'll actually be on those linear corridors, will come jobs, will become opportunities for people for casual employment, and we're knowing more people are going into casual employment. There will be greater access to the city for people who want to live in those areas and get to the city, and so forego the need for a car possibly and save yourself, you know, anywhere between $12,000 to $16,000 a year. So the affordability one is a really interesting thing. I mean, the Australian psyche says the only thing that's affordable is a block on the fringe and a cheap house, usually far too big in this day and age. Whereas, you know, if you equate the cost of transport, the cost of your time, productivity and all those sort of things, the cheapest house is actually in the city because you're getting more productivity closer to, you know, where you can actually get work and all the rest of it. And I think the younger generation are realizing this. I think there is a move back to, you know, more dense mixed-use areas that have a quality of life that you can walk to rather than actually climb in a car and have to drive to.
You're on RN. This is Tom Switzer in for Geraldine Doog this Saturday morning, and we're chatting about our cities and how to make them sustainable. Rob, your third step, I found this very interesting. You're thinking laterally about how to use our existing infrastructure in more efficient ways. Can you give us some examples on what you mean?
Well, I suppose the example I gave you about the free before 7 o'clock is one of those examples.
Yeah, good
but,
one.
One of the things that you almost shouldn't mention in Australia is congestion charging. We will get to congestion charging. I grew up in Zimbabwe. They imposed pre-independent Zimbabwe, there were sanctions. And one night we were told we got 6 coupons with 4 litres attributed to each coupon. Everybody thought that was a disaster. Within weeks, people had met their neighbours, worked out car share. Actually, we got a wider community. So we walk away from these things as though, they're going to be awful. But, imagine if all the people who drive in on one person in a car, and it's a vast majority, actually shared a car. In school holidays, you take 10% of the traffic off the roads. And everybody said, isn't it wonderful during school holidays? We're not talking big percentage points here.
It's changed, though. It's hard to come to grips with for a lot of people.
Well, it's not, because we've got Uber and we've got things like that happening. We've got car share. We will change our attitude, because suddenly we'll realize in our drive to have more stuff and our own stuff, we're really actually not getting the quality of life that we could get if we started to have a more of a sharing economy.
Well, let's change the subject slightly. John, what about the fast train idea from Melbourne through to Sydney? I mean, this gets talked about often, especially when an election's looming. Is the government serious this time?
Well, I think that we've probably not had that conversation in the right context so far. It seems to me the really big issue with the fast train goes to the question of how big we want cities like Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane to be. Do we want Melbourne and Sydney to be 8 million? Is that the right answer for Australia? Or might it be better if they were 7 million each and we tried to distribute a couple of million people throughout the corridor between? And then all of a sudden, high-speed rail becomes a really important enabling mechanism with opportunities to value capture to help pay for it along the route. And I think that's a conversation we need to have, not high-speed rail so much as a train project, but high-speed rail as a settlement policy project for Australia's development in the future.
Rob, what about your other policy lever for sustainable cities? That's setting realistic targets. Is this not happening? And if not, why not?
I think there's a tendency for governments to be scared of targets because, if you set a target and then you don't achieve it, get around to the next election and someone's going to criticise you. But, in many cases, people think, well, if I don't know how to get there, I can't set a target because I'll be criticised. Sometimes it's better the other way around. If you actually say a reasonable target will actually get a change culture coming in. So I think we need to set targets. Densities, one of the densest cities in the world, because earlier on you said, it means high living. Doesn't necessarily. One of the densest cities in the world is Barcelona. It goes to 7 floors. It's not necessarily that we're all going to live in towers, but we do need to start to get populations closer to the things that they need to use. Otherwise, we will get social breakdown.
And what about green space? So both of you, John, there's a big debate in Sydney about stadiums, light rail lines encroaching on parklands. And, you'd think that as cities become more populated, we need more, not less, open green space.
Well, I'm very strongly supportive of the work that Rob and his council have done in the area of urban forests and think that we need to extend those concepts right across all of our cities and into the regional areas as well. So you're developing habitat, wildlife corridors and so on that give everybody in the city access to good open space, natural areas within reasonable walking distance. And so you need open space not only for sort of formal recreational and running around purposes, but also more contact with nature, because what that can do to the well-being of people, to our health and so on, it's really important. And they ought to be planned into our cities as part of the developments that Rob's talking about.
But are governments serious about this, though, Rob?
Well, we're actually doing it. We've taken 86 hectares, and we don't talk about it too often. We can now because it's gone. We've taken 86 hectares of asphalt out of central Melbourne in the last 30 years.
Wow.
If we had to go and buy that open space, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. So, a project that we've got in the books at the moment is South Bank Boulevard, just in front of the studio we're sitting in Melbourne at the moment, where the traffic volumes have dropped from 30,000 down to 15,000. So we can take away half that asphalt. And we can, create a linear park that comes from St Kilda Road all the way down to the river. If we had to go and buy that land, it would cost us something like $170 million. So, you know, there's a perfect example of getting more out of your existing infrastructure. You know, people don't realize that you can't park within 20 meters of a traffic light or an intersection. So you can take that 20 meters as you run up to an intersection, which would normally have cars parked in it, and you can widen the footpath. You can put in catchment, so you actually pick up the water and put moisture back in our soil, all of which is going to be necessary as we heat up as a country.
Encouraging signs. Rob, John, thanks so much for being on RN.
Thank you, Tom.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Rob Adams is Director of City Design and Projects at the City of Melbourne. And Rob has an essay called The Tale of Two Cities in the next edition of the Griffith Review. And John Stanley is an adjunct professor at the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies at the Business School at the University of Sydney.